This is Joel Kotkin.
And this is Marshall Toplansky.
And you're listening to the Feudal Future podcast. Our society is being rapidly reduced to a feudal state, a process now being exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. Millions of small businesses are near extinction. Millions more are losing their jobs. And many others will be stuck in the status of propertyless serfs. The big winners have been the expert class of the clerisy, and most of all, the tech oligarchs, who benefit as people rely more on algorithms than human relationships.
With this, around the world, the middle class is becoming more squeezed than ever, and it's having profound economic, social, and spiritual implications. Here on the show, we're having conversations with business, government, and citizen leaders like you to get to the core of these issues and explore how we can work together to form a better future than the one we're headed towards. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another exciting episode of the Feudal Future podcast. I'm Marshall Toplansky.
I'm Joel Kotkin.
And today we're here to talk about COVID and the vaccines with two eminent scientists, Beth Brown, who is the chief technology officer at Rev Pharmaceuticals, and Ron Jordan, who is the dean of the Chapman University School of Pharmacy. Welcome, both of you.
Yeah, thank you, Marshall.
Nice to be here.
We're delighted to have you here. You know, it's so interesting to me to look at the world that we're living in and realize, despite all of the, you know, nitpicking about who's getting the vaccine, who's not getting the vaccine, how quickly it's rolling out, we have never had a vaccination program in human history that has happened this quickly. What do you think happened that was able to accelerate the pace of all of this?
I think, Marshall, a lot of it has to do with prioritization. And also a lot of work being done behind the scenes that wasn't just, you know, out there and a focus for individuals who were living their normal life. You know, SARS and MERS, there was a lot of research being done when those outbreaks occurred. A lot of efforts in the vaccine space for mRNA, as well as adenovectors or other types of vectors. So there was decades of research to build upon. And these platforms, these drug delivery systems are very flexible, and you can make them at small scale, and then they're able to be scaled up. And so when all this came about, there were a lot of people that came forward and said, hey, we can do this. And so then it also became FDA saying, we are not going to skimp on any kind of, you know, rigor around data integrity, data quality, safety. But we believe that because we have such a body of people that we can enroll in clinical trials, we can do this very quickly and actually do a number of things simultaneously. And then the other piece that came into play is governments and other institutions providing funding to say, we're willing to back the manufacturing. So where normally there would be a cadence to looking at something in the clinic early, establishing safety, and then kind of rolling it into efficacy, and then saying, okay, now we're ready to pull the trigger on manufacturing. All those triggers were pulled at the same time. And that's really what you're seeing. And there was a company I just finished with the regulatory submission for a COVID vaccine. And the FDA was at their doorstep within a couple months. This is a different type of, visit than they normally do. But they were, you know, it's analogous to basically going there and kicking the tires and saying, yeah.
So they were being very unusually proactive, is what you're saying.
Right. And so, you know, we're willing to buy. And so keep going. And so I think a lot of those things with them all aligning, and, you know, obviously there's probably some luck associated with it as well, has gotten us to where we are today.
And Ron, how do you see it? You look at it probably from a more downstream perspective, I presume.
Well, yeah, but I think Beth is right that the changing the process from being serial to being simultaneous, where we went and allowed a lot of things to occur and investment to occur without having all the normal steps and waiting for that. And then the cooperation among scientists that was possible because of where we are in the world technologically today. A lot of cooperation, a lot of sharing of the technology, the mRNA technology has been shared, and people were able to innovate around that and work on different approaches to the virus. So I think it was really a miracle of all the right things coming together at once. And we're lucky that we are where we are today.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also important that in the pharma world, and I don't know if everybody really has an appreciation for this, but there's always a lot of activity, opportunity, but often there's a lot of failures. And there's an article that was put together in January where they were through the World Health Organization, they currently stated that there were 64 vaccines for COVID that were in phase one through phase three. And there was 173 that were in preclinical trials. So, you know, you don't often hear, you hear about the top five or six, but you're not going to hear necessarily about those other ones. But those other ones may also become very important later on. Sorry.
Yeah, you don't. I'm sorry. I jumped on you there. You don't hear about the losers. You just hear about the winners.
Right. But those other ones may have a role in the future. And you know, when it's time to talk about those, we probably should revisit that. Because they may have better stability, they may be more effective, they may be more versatile platforms to, you know, handle variants. A lot of things related to that.
I guess the $64 million goes today, it's probably $64 trillion question. How close are we getting between, let's say, the three that have been approved in the U.S., so Pfizer, Moderna, and J&J? How close are we to turning this around and to a point where it goes from pandemic to endemic? And do you have a time frame for that?
Well, I think we know that we're going to be able to get a lot of COVID vaccine into people's arms by summer, fall at the latest, and that's much faster than we expected. But, you know, you had asked about herd immunity and are we going to potentially be able to eliminate this virus from the face of the earth? And I think that personally, that's unlikely. You know, the trying to get to that level of nearly 225 million people in the United States having immunity and then doing the same in countries all over the world at 60-70% of the people already immune is going to be very difficult. So we'll probably get to where it can be endemic in different parts of the world and maybe the United States by fall, but it will go on and it will take years for this to really become something that we're able to deal with. And likely there may be other things that happen in that time frame.
I've got a question for you about viruses.
I was just wondering what Seth might be thinking about this. Do you have the same view?
Yes, I agree with Ron. I think it's a different, you answer differently if you're talking about in the US versus other parts of the world and the rollout of the vaccine and availability. And, you know, really the ability to snuff this vaccine or this virus out relates to keeping the spread down, because when it's spread is when it mutates. And we kind of all know that now. But if we can get people vaccinated, if people have the immunity through having it as well, that hopefully we get to a point where, you know, it is something that is more like the influenza. But we may be battling that for years. But, you know, again, if as long as everyone has the vaccine or there's a herd immunity to prevent most people from getting it, we'll at least not be in a situation where we have been with the hospitalizations and the deaths.
How is battling viruses different from battling bacteria?
I mean, they both have the opportunity to mutate, right? So it's just that we've had antibiotics that have been able to kill the bacteria. And for the viruses, we don't have antibiotics, and antivirals are not specific enough in most cases. And so the vaccine is the tool that will allow us to be successful. And, you know, ultimately what we're doing is we are putting, we're injecting something into the body, which is a protein that's unique to the virus, but the protein itself is not, you know, going to hurt you. But you have the opportunity to, your body reacts to it and says, I'm going to make an antibody to this. This is not normal. This is not, you know, what we want to see. And so then you create those antibodies and you have that protection. And like I said, both the mRNA format and the vector format drug delivery system really allows you to modify that protein over time. And that seems to be where the variants are coming in. The coronavirus, it's that name because it's like a crown. It has those spikes on it. And that spike protein is really what your body is making an antibody against. And so you, when they say it is the vaccine is good against a specific, you know, is good against a specific variant, it's because that variant hasn't modified itself to the extent that, you know, the antibodies aren't going to basically, you know, say we're not going to allow this to, you know, turn into an active COVID-19 infection. So I think that's the tool for the future. Ron, do you have any?
My answer would have been that with bacteria, we use chemical entities to attack the bacteria themselves. With vaccines, we use the body and its own immune system to attack the invading element. And so, you know, with bacteria, that's hard because bacteria replicate in a very different way than most of the viruses that are using the body to replicate. So we're able to use the immune system, our own systems, to help ourselves with viruses, and that's what's different, and that's what's amazing about the virus technology that has been developing, as Beth said, for many decades now, and is now in this particular case at its pinnacle of delivering fast, very effective, highly effective, maybe the most effective vaccines we've ever had. 95% effectiveness rate is kind of unheard of with vaccines.
Yeah.
One thing is, you know, we've obviously the vaccine and the new ones may be coming down the road. It's an amazing achievement. What is your assessment of the distribution? You know, there's been a lot of frustration in different states and cities. Should we cut these people a break, or could it have been done better?
I think in that area that we could have done better if we had recognized that we needed a multi-pronged attack, and we utilized the entire healthcare system better than we did by recognizing that, for instance, in pharmacies, there's a lot of data and a lot of the people at most risk are regular customers. Pharmacies are highly accessible. If we had used, like some states did, the pharmacy supply chain that existed already to get vaccines into not only the healthcare facilities, but other communities where people could be served, including communities for the underserved, we would have been a lot better off, because pharmacies have been delivering vaccines to the tune of about 90 million a year already. And when really amped up and focused, we could have probably delivered a lot more through the community pharmacy system. So where you see in West Virginia and Texas and North Dakota, South Dakota, they utilize, those governors made decisions to utilize the existing supply chain in pharmacy simultaneous with some mass vaccination. But it would work better, I think, if we had done that.
Is that an issue also, the supply chain, or is that an issue with the actual vaccines themselves? My sense is that there's a globalization of the supply chain, and has it worked smoothly in being able to get all of the components of the product together, or have there been kind of similar dislocations within that supply chain?
Well, I mean, we've been vaccinating in community pharmacy for more than a decade now, about 15 years, and been doing it very well in many, many different areas of vaccination. So I think that supply chain was fine. There were some challenges as we started to contemplate the size of this problem. So, you know, we had to get Corning making glass in a totally different way than we had before. And there were some other challenges like that. But, you know, I'm not sure that those could be called disruptions of the supply chain. I think that in the United States, the supply chain worked very well. Some of the global supply chains even now are still disrupted in some areas. So that can be difficult. But, you know, I'm convinced that we had a very good opportunity in pharmacy that we didn't utilize, although we're starting to now.
Right. I think there are different entities out there making sure that if there's shortages, you know, sometimes the shortages are now for the prescription products that aren't COVID related, where they're going to see possibly some shortages. So there's definitely some entities out there, you know, monitoring that situation. I think, you know, for me personally, I think the sheer ability of time it takes to manufacture the product and then test it to release it, you know, again, in a very safe manner, we're releasing it just like we do any other product. So, you know, some of it is related to the timing there. And, you know, I can't speak necessarily for other states. I know Minnesota, I think, is at 21%, has at least one vaccine dose. And I think that's similar to other places, but, you know, other places have been more successful. And right now, I think it is a supply issue. One, you know, I actually yesterday called my provider and, you know, Health Network. And they said, okay, we are following just these people and we've notified these people that they can get it. And we don't have extra. And we don't, you know, so we're not opening it up completely to the full list that the governor said would be able to get the shot at this point in time. Then I called the Public Health Service of Minnesota, and they said kind of a similar thing, that you can, that you're part of a program, you're on a list, they will let you know. And then they're connected more with the actual community pharmacies where you can get it. And they said there's a possibility that you could call your county public health or your provider themselves. And if there is an exception to get you on the short list, then you need to work with them. So in my opinion, there's lots of layers right now. I'm not saying that it's perfect, and I'm not blaming anybody, but I'm saying is once there is more available, then you'll be able to get more of these mass events where we go to the convention center and we're able to vaccinate large numbers of people. And I currently am part of the Minnesota Responders vaccine group. And they contacted me about 2 weeks ago. I did my online training, and their response to me was, we're probably going to have these larger mass vaccination events occurring in late spring to early summer. So even though I'm ready to go, and I know there's a lot of other volunteers ready to go, we're waiting on the actual vaccine to be able to, you know, kind of close that gap.
I think in order to get to, 200 million Americans and a lot of young people, a lot of people not at risk, it's going to take more of the mass vaccinations and more supply. But the point that I think we could have done a better job on is we know the people at risk in pharmacy nationwide, and we could have gotten to the most at-risk people with comorbidities, et cetera, faster with less of a hassle if we had turned that over to community pharmacy and asked them to make contact, like your health system has, with the priority people in order to get there. And I think that could have been done a little better, but it is what it is at this point. I think we'll rely on that system going forward on an annual basis to a much bigger extent, as well as health systems and physicians' offices. All of those people will continue to engage in vaccination. The other beauty of this whole thing is it's raising awareness about how important immunization is, because we have a number of areas where our population is under immunized and we need to fix that.
I was just wondering also maybe if we expand it to a global level. I mean, obviously there have been problems in the US, but my wife's family's from Canada and they've actually seem to have done really not well at all. It's a country with a national health insurance. You'd think they would have been easy. Same thing in Europe. I mean, the big success story, of course, is Israel. Why are we seeing such different results in different countries, particularly given the fact that we could tamp down the pandemic in America, but it can come from another country? Why is there such a huge variant between and particularly shocked at these countries that we usually think of as being very efficient, like Germany or the Scandinavian countries? Any sense on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would just be guessing, so I don't want to say I'm an authority on this at all, but I do have family in the UK and I've been kind of watching that. And, obviously with AstraZeneca, they were very quick to get the contracts in place. And it's kind of my understanding that some of the contracts in some of the other countries, and maybe it's because they're all part of the European Union, that there was, some misconnects or disconnects in all of that. So I think there is some business aspects to all of this that are driving some of those disparities. I wish that wasn't the case, but, I am aware because of the vaccine program I was involved with for the last year that, that company in particular is making manufacturing a priority in each of those regions of the world. And so to a large extent, they are all making, in those countries, their own supplies. And of course, as there's extra and that type of thing, it may be going to a different region of the world. But oftentimes, the way that the regulatory submissions are put together, the drug substance is made in a certain place, and then it goes to another contract manufacturer for the drug product to be made. Now, if that drug substance is only approved to make for a certain region's supply, then product that is made with another drug substance is only good in a certain other region, and you can't sell that other second source unless you've put it part of your regulatory submission. And so there may be some aspects of that as well. And maybe there's also some compromising going on saying, okay, if this region of the world has accepted this manufacturer or this drug substance, we will too. And again, I'm not knowledgeable of that, that would kind of help perhaps with the situation.
It sounds like what you're calling out really is kind of government ball hogging, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Where one government says, no, this is my territory. I get to put the stamp on it. I see you nodding, Ron. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah. I mean, we're living in a global society, but we don't have global regulatory harmonization, and it's taken years and years to even get cooperation between some of the regulators in different parts of the world. And then you complicate it with things like the Eurozone being created, and then, you know, Britain is going to Brexit, and all of those things, government control over the health of and safety of their citizens, which is really their primary role, is it's not fully harmonized. That's all I can say.
Yeah, well, you know, there was an article in today's Wall Street Journal that I thought brought this alive, which was how the Chinese are handling this. They're basically saying, hey, we're looking forward to opening up. We're going to expedite visas for people who have been vaccinated, but we're not going to let people in unless you've been vaccinated with a Chinese vaccine.
Real? Oh, my God.
So this is, you know, they're not recognizing any of the other. By the way, they don't seem to be recognizing the Russian vaccine or the AstraZeneca vaccine either. So you have to have one of the five Chinese vaccines. Otherwise, we're not letting you into the country. So I think that's really reinforces the point about parochiality.
Yeah. So, you know, this has been really great. The thing I'd like to just focus on as we wrap up is, what lessons can we learn from this? I mean, given the fact that, you know, it's likely that we're going to see this again or something like it again, what have we learned, and what, you know, how can we go forward so that the next time we don't have the kind of results that we had this time?
Well, I think we learned that certain groups are vulnerable more than others to different types of infectious disease or pandemic things like this. Let's say it was children next time, we'd need to be able to prioritize in a different way. Mm-hmm. And I think we have the data within the health system, if we utilize it, to make those kind of decisions once we know the target populations. And so to me, you know, recognizing that we had to get to people over a certain age and people with comorbidities, it's likely that people with comorbidities will always be a challenge. And it probably would have been helpful if we had been going after people with comorbidities, you know, from 16 to 65 from day one, and we could have protected more people, it seems to me. But we didn't really do that. So that's one lesson I think that we've learned.
I think there's definitely, you know, to look across at the lessons learned, like even with the Seattle area, they were some of the first that had COVID. They were some of the first deaths in the nation, and they could have easily become, you know, like a New York City, some of the other California urban areas. And in the end, they weren't. Now, there's maybe some aspects of that related to the health of those individuals, although, you know, obviously they have full ages of populations, et cetera, there, you know, but maybe they were a little more apt to follow, you know, masks and social distancing. They were some of the first to do remote working and do some shutdowns that I think helped their area as well. So I think it's really looking at those types of things and kind of also evolving our thinking. Like, you know, that they just came out with the Harvard University of Massachusetts School of Medicine, where they showed that they looked at 500,000 students, and as long as they were wearing masks, they could be 3 feet apart or 6 feet apart. Now, logistically, that is a huge deal, you know, deal breaker to keep all these students so far apart. If they can relax some of those things and really understand some of that piece, then we'll just be that wiser in the future, and then also not be as restrictive. And as long as everybody's willing to say it's okay to wear a mask, I mean, even before the pandemic, if any one of you traveled internationally, right, there would people be wearing masks all the time, you know, and maybe we're thinking, oh, that's, you know, maybe a little bit conservative or whatever, but, you know, so be it. So it's not that big of, you know, a sacrifice when all is said and done.
Well, the point that you were making earlier that, you know, as we look back on this, one of the lessons we've learned is we've learned a lot. You know, we've really done a tremendous amount of innovation in both the design, development, and manufacturing and distribution this go round, so that hopefully it will put us in good stead for the next one.
But I also think, you know, the question is, how has it changed our views on how do we run transit? How do we ventilate? I mean, I know at Chapman, we have changed the ventilation systems. Are there important lessons that we've learned that are even beyond the pandemic, that, you know, after the Spanish flu, if you read the Great Plague, that, you know, that's when we started to see what we used to call sewer socialism, you know, clean up the sanitation systems, you know, move away from the kind of very crowded tenement housing, because those tenement districts in New York in particular were particularly hard hit. Are we going to be looking at, and maybe have we learned things about health that we need to do on after this pandemic, like we did after the Spanish flu?
Seems to me that we have learned about hygiene and things like that. You know, Beth mentioned wearing masks. If people are during flu season feeling ill, if they wear a mask, they're protecting other people. That's the key. You know, the protection for oneself in that environment is not that huge, but the amount of effect that you can have on other people if you're ill is maybe something that the public understands better now and will do something about, because that could help in a future pandemic. I think you're right, you know, changing the infrastructure for places that we gather. I wonder whether I'm ever going to get back to the Honda Center for a hockey game, you know, and what conditions it'll be, and whether I'll have to have my vaccine passport to get into the building. It's going to be really interesting to see.
Separate from whether the Ducks ever actually win a game.
Well, you got to leave the hockey to the Minnesotans.
Right. Well, Beth and Ron, thank you so much for joining us. This was just fascinating, and really appreciate your expertise and the role you've played in making this pandemic recovery as strong as it's been. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.